In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with two physicians who've authored a book that takes a look at how parents can think about putting together the best of conventional and alternative medicine when it comes to keeping their children healthy. The title of their book is Healthy Child, Whole Child. It is published by HarperCollins, and we have both authors of the book with us by telephone this morning. Dr. Stuart Ditchick is a practicing pediatrician. He's fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He's also clinical assistant professor of pediatrics at New York University School of Medicine, and he lives in Brooklyn. Dr. Russell Greenfield was one of the first four physicians nationwide to be admitted to Dr. Andrew Weil's program in integrative medicine at University of Arizona Health Sciences Center. He is the director of Carolina's Integrative Health in Charlotte, North Carolina, does a lot of speaking on topics related to integrative medicine, and he lives in Charlotte. And they're, as I say, they're both joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, people who are listening are certainly welcome to call and ask their own questions. Whatever's on your mind, I know our guests will do their best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers and the letters, you get WILL. So it's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, if you have questions, you can call. All we ask of people who are calling is to just try and be brief, and we just ask that so we can keep things moving along and try to get in as many people as we can. We'll say hello to our guests. Dr. Ditchick, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us. And Dr. Greenfield.
Hi, David.
I'll see if I can get your names and your voices now together in my head so I can figure out which is which. If I get goofed up, you'll have to forgive me. Maybe to start, what I would do is ask you, the very first chapter of the book, the title of the chapter is Read This First, What You Need to Know to Get the Most from This Book. And what this is it's a discussion of integrative medicine and integrative pediatrics, so people will have some idea, well, what exactly does that mean? So that's probably a pretty good place to start. And I don't know which one of you would like maybe it makes sense for me to start and ask Dr. Greenfield to talk a little bit about that. What is integrative medicine?
Well, you know, thank you very much, David, because it really is a good place to start. We like to create a distinction between integrative medicine and what some people call alternative or complementary medicine. You know, Dr. Stu and I are both conventionally trained physicians, having gone through medical school, internship, residency, etc. I put that forth to you because, you know, we like the idea of conventional medicine to a point. We like to believe that we have a good sense of its limitations as well as its benefits. And the same can be said of alternative therapies. So we don't like the term alternative medicine because that implies we're using something instead of conventional medicine. And that's not where we come from. We also don't like the term complementary and alternative medicine, as some people put forth, because that still puts the idea that conventional medicine is the centerpiece, and then it's a little like going into a restaurant menu and taking a little of this, a little of that, a little massage therapy, a little herbs. It really doesn't have a founding philosophy. But integrative medicine does, because we put forth that the role of a physician who practices in an integrative fashion is to sit in partnership with a parent or a patient and to utilize the best of conventional and or alternative therapies to support that person's own innate healing capability. So it really is a trust that we all have strong innate healing capabilities within us, and that the role of a physician is to support that through the judicious use of the best of alternative and complementary therapies.
Mm. Well, maybe let me turn to your co-author, and maybe then I'll ask the further question, and maybe you can talk a little bit about how it is that you apply these principles to pediatrics.
Well, that's a great point, David. In pediatrics, this is kind of a new endeavor, I would say. You know, many pediatricians are integrative pediatricians, although they may not label themselves as such. And the reason is that they value the relationships that have existed for generations between parents and pediatricians that nurture the healing process in children. So although they don't label themselves as integrative, a good basis of what integrative pediatrics is just utilizing that relationship with a child and with a parent to create the partnership that's needed to delve into these other areas, which are really gray areas. You know, we're looking now at new research, and sometimes we're looking at old research, but integrative pediatricians need to learn more about what these therapies are and what the benefits and really primarily what the risks are for children. Yeah. And that's what Dr. Russ and I try to propose a lot of, is safe care for children. And that means that parents cannot experiment on kids. They need to work with their pediatrician to figure out which of these remedies and which of these therapies and preventative approaches are safe for kids.
You mentioned a number of things here specifically when you talk about the principles of integrative pediatric medicine. But one that particularly strikes me, I guess I'm not exactly sure why, though, is the very last thing that you mentioned. You say that one thing that you have to realize is that children are not small adults. And yet it seems to me that in many ways, medicine for some time has been operating as if they were small adults.
Absolutely. You know, the best evidence of that is the recent decision by the FDA to now insist on testing of drugs in children under 12 years of age rather than just applying safety labels when those drugs were never tested in children under 12 years of age. So clearly the agenda nationally by the FDA and the federal government is to create a safer environment for children. I think it's going to take a long time for that to happen, but the applications in integrative medicine are fairly comparable. For instance, many parents go out and shop for herbal remedies, which they are told by health food store clerks are safe for children, but clearly some of them are not, and some of them are being misused, and sometimes the parent is buying the wrong herbal remedy or the wrong brand. So making it safe for kids is really a great challenge, and it doesn't only exist in integrative medicine. It exists in conventional medicine as well, and it's only now coming to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. And David, you know, to add on to what Dr. Stu was saying, you know, there are a lot of parents out there who are willing to, let's say, experiment on themselves using different vitamins, supplements, and herbs to try and optimize their health. But most of those people are not willing to experiment with their kids. And that was part of the genesis of this book, was how, you know, as Dr. Stu and I are both parents of young children, and this is the kind of thing that we wanted to know, what can be used safely to optimize a child's health in any given situation. So really the focus is on prevention and then on safety.
Mm. Well, that's, I think it's an excellent point that people seem to be very curious and very interested in alternative approaches. We certainly know that they're very popular, that over-the-counter, quote-unquote, natural medicine products are very popular, but it seems to be very difficult to know for sure what's really going on with these things. Not only does a particular thing have any effect, but even if you go to the store and you take down a bottle off the shelf that it has a label on it that says, well, it's got this thing in there, you don't even exactly know what's in there. So there's a big issue of standardization of product, quality control, and then the larger issue of, well, does this thing do what you think that it's going to do? All of that is difficult enough if you're just doing this for yourself. But if you're also making that leap and thinking, well, you know, what's good for me is good for the kids, it seems to me that's even more problematic.
Right. And that, it speaks specifically to taking things like herbs and vitamins and supplements. But there are many, many things that we can offer to our children that don't have to do with reaching for the pill bottle or anything of that nature. And again, some of the things we talk about in our book and that Dr. Stu can talk about with regard specifically to his practice. But, you know, things that you would imagine, eating healthily, making certain that children are getting active so that they can maintain their fitness, making certain that you can recognize the signs of stress in a child. There are many parents who walk around thinking that their children couldn't possibly be stressed because they're too young. All they got to do is go to school. But kids indeed do have stress. They just have different types of stress that maybe we don't remember quite so well as when we were children. Stu, why don't you talk about some of the things that you use in your practice?
Well, I think stress is a great place to start. As Dr. Russ pointed out, I think the most dramatic response from parents is when you point out that their child has a stress-related illness or a stress-related symptom. I think almost universally parents will look at you and say, how can my child be stressed? What are they thinking about? And the reality is that children have the same stress as we do, and in some instances actually much more dramatic than our stresses, and their physical complaints related to them are usually very dramatic. Headaches are typical of that, abdominal pain, very often poor feeding or vomiting in a young newborn. There's many, many stress-related symptoms, and probably in my practice, the most common stress-related illness during the winter especially are recurrent infections. I practice in a community where a lot of the kids go to parochial school programs with double programs, where they spend hours from 8 in the morning till 6:30 at night in school, and very often when it gets dark early in the winter and they get home and it's dark and they have no playtime, these children come in with much more frequent infections. And once you point out that they're lacking sleep and not getting enough sunlight and maybe not eating the way they should in the winter, parents kind of jump on that bandwagon and figure out better ways to relieve their stress and improve their diet and improve their social circumstance, and the infections get less and less. And I think that's what we're trying to emphasize here, to look at the cause, the root cause of problems in children. Don't assume everything can be fixed, as Dr. Russ said, in a pill bottle or in an herbal bottle.
Sure.
A lot of those things need to be fixed at home and in school, and then you get good results.
Maybe very quickly here, we'll introduce again our guests for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We have, as our guest, two physicians. Stuart Ditchick is a practicing pediatrician. He's also clinical assistant professor of pediatrics at New York University School of Medicine. Russell Greenfield is also a physician. He is director of Carolina's Integrative Health in Charlotte, North Carolina, and does a lot of speaking around the world on topics related to integrative medicine, and he lives in North Carolina. Together, they are the authors of the book Healthy Child, Whole Child, and it is published by HarperCollins, so it should be out there in the bookstore. And as we've been talking about here, the subtitle sort of tells you what the book is about. It's about integrating the best of conventional and alternative medicine to keep your kids healthy. Just here, the first section of the book is about things that parents can do to try to help their children's immune system stay strong and healthy. And there's a list of things, and some of them we've actually, because I think that there is a stress component here, we've sort of talked about things like, you know, make sure your kids get enough sleep and make sure that they have a good balanced diet and so forth. One specific thing here I wanted to ask you about, and there may be some other things you'd like to mention, but that is, You suggest people should refrain from the urge to reach for antibiotics and antibacterial products. I think more and more now certainly physicians are sensitive to the product of overuse of antibiotics in their prescribing. But there's another issue here because antibacterials, it seems now that it's in everything. It's in soaps, it's in house cleaning products, you can get antibacterial cutting boards for your kitchen. They're everywhere, and I know that there is another, you know, there's sort of the same kind of concern about overprescribing exists to overuse of these kind of products that anybody can just go, you know, you just go in the store and you buy this stuff. How would you encourage people to think about that?
Stu, why don't you talk about the antibiotic stuff, and I'll take the other aspect.
Okay, Dr. Russell, speak of the hygiene hypothesis. But from an antibiotics perspective, I think that one of the hardest realizations for us as physicians was coming to the conclusion that we were over-medicating children. And pediatricians are especially sensitive to this because, quite frankly, they see more children with requirements for antibiotics than any other specialty. Right now, there's approximately somewhere between 30 and 35 million prescriptions a year written for ear infections, for instance, in the United States. And what we as pediatricians have recognized in the last few years is that we're probably over-treating even ear infections. So what Dr. Russ and I advocate is a system whereby you don't have to treat every ear infection in a child older than a year of age. And we're not alone. The American Academy of Pediatrics is coming out with guidelines for ear infection antibiotic reduction this fall, which will further educate pediatricians on how to better reduce the use of antibiotics. Parents are great partners in this overuse, I have to say. We're not alone guilty. Parents carry a lot of the guilt because they demand antibiotics frequently when they come into the office for many different types of infections. So pediatricians are nice guys in general. They usually comply and give the antibiotic. But we're learning how not to be such nice guys when it comes to antibiotics. And I think as a result, we're going to see some very dramatic decreases. In my practice, I've cut down the use of antibiotics for ear infections by approximately 70% in the last 3 years, and we've seen very dramatic results within our patient population. Dr. Russ, I know, has had very similar experiences. I'd like to give him the opportunity just to comment on the second part of, you know, reducing improving immunity when it comes to bacterial resistance.
Sure. Go ahead.
Also, I wanted to just tag on with what Dr. Stu was saying, because, you know, in other parts of the globe, they really do trust that children can heal themselves. So, yes, they may prescribe an antibiotic for the ear infection, but they give the child 24 to 48 hours to see if they're going to get better on their own, since such a significant proportion of ear infections can be related to viruses rather than bacteria. So, you know, it's not that we're putting forth something that's so radical. It's just a trust that in many instances the children have the capability to heal themselves. With regards to the antiseptics and antibacterial products that are available out there, it seems ubiquitous, because it is everywhere. You can buy, just as you were saying, the soaps and the cutting boards and things of that nature. Well, there's an interesting theory out there called the hygiene hypothesis that actually really got put forth quite a bit when the Berlin Wall came down. They actually, one of the researchers took a look and said, well, you know, between East Germany and West Germany, it's very likely that there's more asthma and allergy in an underdeveloped country like East Germany. So we're just going to look at the statistics and prove it once and for all. And they looked at the statistics, and interestingly enough, there was actually more asthma and allergy in West Germany, the supposedly more industrialized nation, than in East Germany. They started looking at things, and they came up with the idea that in West Germany, children were growing up in what might be called cement cities. They weren't getting exposed to the kinds of organisms that human beings have been exposed to throughout our existence, mainly from the dirt and from the natural surroundings that we've been involved in and lived in throughout our existence. And the thought is maybe our immune systems aren't getting, oh, for lack of a better word, exercised as much as they used to when they were exposed to the organisms throughout our society and throughout our cultures. Now that we are exposed to the cement cities and the antiseptics and the antibacterials, if the immune system doesn't have the opportunity to, again, exercise itself, perhaps it then starts to exercise against its own systems, against the cells of its own human body. And maybe that's why there are more allergies, and maybe that's why there's more autoimmune disorders, and maybe that's why there's partly the reason why there's an increase in the incidence of asthma. It's a very interesting hypothesis, and there is some data out there to show that, indeed, this may play a role in the increased incidence of this. So what we put forth, what Dr. Stu and I put forth, is that, as with so many things, it's about moderation. Being careful with regards to not letting your children play with things that are, you know, obviously very dirty, and teaching them how to wash their hands and things of that nature. But let them get dirty every once in a while. Let them play in the dirt, and don't go overboard with the antiseptic and antibacterial types of products.
Mm. Well, you do want them to, obviously, as you say, you do want them to practice basic, good basic hygiene. How do you get your kids to wash their hands? Pick something really basic like that.
Well, Stu and I have each our own approach to this, and Stu's is a song, which actually, Stu, I hope you'll sing for it. And mine is actually getting the kids to suds up their hands real well. And then what I've done with my own children is I get them to put their middle or their index finger right next to their thumb and create a little circle and then widen that out, and you get a little bubble there. And you can actually put the bubble from each hand together and make a bigger bubble, and you can blow bubbles while doing it. So the kids have lots and lots of fun, and they blow bubbles, and they get their hands nice and sudsy and washed up that way.
Russ actually has a lot more fun than the kids when doing that.
Well, we won't make you sing, but is there another approach?
Well, one thing that we do in our house, we have kind of these neat soap containers that are different animal shapes or different characters that the younger kids in our family tend to enjoy using. So it becomes habit after a while. They know, for instance, that when they get home from school, they wash their hands immediately when they come through the door. You know, the bacteria that you pick up in a daycare center in a kindergarten are much more dangerous and much more disease-causing bacteria than you would pick up in your backyard, for instance. So my kids kind of know, when they have to overdo the hand washing, when they don't. And one time they always overdo hand washing is when they get home from school. when they come in from playing outside, we usually have them wash their hands before they eat dinner, but certainly it's not as ritualistic. And I think kids pick up on those cues from their parents. You know, as a pediatrician, I'm used to washing my hands a lot because I'm in the office all day and I'm seeing children with viral and bacterial infections, and that's the only way I can protect myself. Mm-hmm. And they know that I'm in my office, I'm washing my hands a lot. But when I'm home, you know, we're much more liberal about it. And I think that's really the goal, for you to be a role model for your kids.
Yeah.
And they need to see what you're doing.
Well, and I think that even adults, it's probably something we should be conscious of. From time to time, you hear about these studies where people have gone around and started culturing stuff. And they, you know, they culture doorknobs,
right,
desktops, computers, you know, go into a public washroom and start culturing stuff. Just the kinds of surfaces that we know all of us do touch and come into contact with all the time. And you culture those, and you start to get some pretty scary stuff.
Right, you do. Well, Dr. Stu is being very shy about his singing voice. But another fun thing that kids can do and that parents can just instill is, you know, you just teach children to sing the Happy Birthday song or to sing their ABCs while they're washing their hands. And that's usually enough time to make certain that their hands are getting sudsed up and things of that nature. Because otherwise, you know, kids just have the tendency to just, you know, pop some soap on real quickly on the palms of their hands, wash it off, and run away. And that's not a good way to wash the hands.
Or not use soap at all.
Yeah. We're just about at our midpoint here. We have a caller we'll get right to, and again, I will introduce our guests, Drs. Stuart Ditchick and Russell Greenfield. They are the co-authors of the book Healthy Child, Whole Child, Integrating the Best of Conventional and Alternative Medicine to Keep Your Kids Healthy. It is published by HarperCollins. And questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go, and if other people are listening and they'd like to call in, you're welcome to do that. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We also have a toll-free line for you if it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello. I would like to ask the guests if they are familiar with a particular theory and if they have some more information about it and if what their opinion is. Now, this came to me second hand, so I don't have any like first hand research that I can quote you. But here's the idea: the way it was explained to me, there's a theory that many of our health problems, including health problems in children, might be affected by the fact that the food that we eat no longer has trace minerals in it that our body needs. Because at one time, when people ate food that was more directly coming from the earth, they could absorb these trace minerals. And since so much of our food now is manufactured, we lose that, and we don't have sufficient trace minerals. And then that, in turn, can lead to health problems. Is that something you're familiar with?
Well, I think both Dr. Stu and I can speak to this. You know, the theory goes just as you put forth, that perhaps we don't have the same degree of trace minerals in our soils and things of that nature. Indeed, there has been a problem with over-farming of some of the soil. And so things like, as an example, selenium has been depleted from much of the southeast where I live. So there is concern about that type of thing. However, not so much that Dr. Stu and I feel that children need to have vitamin supplementation in the early years.
Okay.
You know, Dr. Stu and I typically stay away from that until age 4 or 5, unless a child is severely deficient in getting exposure to some of the vitamins and minerals from their diet. In general, kids get what they need from the foods that their parents provide for them, especially in those early years. After that, it's not a bad idea just as a hedge, because, you know, kids may not necessarily eat as healthily as possible, to give them a multivitamin that will provide some of the antioxidants, some of the minerals such as zinc and selenium and things of that nature, to try and be a hedge against the potentials of not getting an adequate diet. Now, a lot of farmers are taking steps to try and prevent this problem by adding more nutrients to the soil, by switching crops at different times of year and things of that nature. And so hopefully this will be addressed, because this is recognized. As to whether it actually is a cause for some of the diseases out there, that remains an area for debate. It is clear that supplementing with some of these vitamins and minerals such as zinc and things of that nature can enhance activity of the immune system, maybe even help prevent diarrheal illnesses, and that has also been shown to help prevent illnesses in adults and especially those in elder care situations. So this is an area that is ripe for research and an area where there will be a lot more information coming out.
And I think the only thing I would add to that would be that many of the foods that children eat have the adequate amounts on the label, at least, of these trace minerals, but either during the processing of those foods or during while a child eats other foods, they can actually decrease the absorption of those minerals. And the perfect example is the use of carbonated beverages or soda. Soda impairs the ability to absorb calcium properly through the GI tract. And, you know, one of the things that we worry about in today's society is how much soda children are drinking. Aside from the amount of sugar in the soda and chemicals, there's also the issue of carbonation. And it is quite frankly a little scary to hear that there's a new product coming out on the market, which we read about a few months ago, called Emu, which is a carbonated milk drink.
Oh, no.
And I kid you not. And that product will be hitting the shelves and will be touted as a great way to get calcium into your child. So there's an example of where, you know, what you're mixing with the actual food or drink is going to impair absorption of the mineral or of the metal or of the vitamin that you're giving along with it. So I think commercialization of foods has led to probably some bad inability to, or poor inability to absorb a lot of those trace minerals.
Thank you. May I ask an additional question? I don't want to tie up the line.
No, yeah, go ahead.
So far we've been talking about young children, but in my case, my children are teenagers. And a concern that I have about them is they are both very, very athletic. For example, my son is starting, you know, two-a-day football practices this week, and they're growing. And so when I was sort of learning about this trace mineral thing, I'm wondering, do we see problems that can come up in teenagers?
I think the same can be said for teenagers as we're talking about adults. Mm-hmm. I think with growing teens, it may even be a little bit more of an issue. But essentially, you know, adults have to be certain that they're getting a well-balanced diet, and it's not a bad idea at all for adults and growing kids to be getting a good multivitamin that contains things like, you know, vitamin E, that contains calcium and magnesium, that contains zinc and copper and selenium and things of that nature. Again, you know, as a hedge against, as a teen, you know, kids are just a little bit more likely to go on out and get that fast food and to hang with their friends and eat some things that aren't necessarily healthy for them.
Well,
but it also speaks again to the idea that this is a family approach, and as Dr. Stu and I put forth, is that, you know, in terms of trying to get adequate nutrition and things like that, it's a good idea for you to be taking a good multivitamin, too, if you're going to be offering that to the kids.
Well, in terms of their athletic activities, I mean, since, you know, for example, they're going to sweat a lot, does that mean they lose more? Or?
Oh, yeah, I think dramatically, very much, not only in teenagers but in younger children, nobody drinks enough water. We really make a very strong point in the book that drinking water not only improves the hydration of your muscles and allows all the normal physiological processes to work better, but it also affects your immune system. You know, you need water to hydrate the cells of your body to function normally. And most Americans don't drink enough water, or they drink it in the form of juices or carbonated beverages or caffeinated beverages. So I think an important thing for your boys would be, number one, to increase their water consumption very dramatically when they're training. Mm-hmm. Number two, to make sure that they're not drinking caffeine in those beverages, because that can impair the ability to train properly. And just making sure they don't drink too many carbonated beverages, which will impair the absorption of the good stuff, and it will also impair their ability to drink enough water, because you fill up more quickly on carbonated beverages than on water.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about this with me.
It's a pleasure to speak with you.
All right, let's continue. We have a caller here next in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
It sounds like a wonderful book, and I would like you to repeat the name of it so I can get it for my children and grandchildren. And also, I have a question.
Okay. Well, why don't you? I will repeat the name of the book in probably a couple minutes. Why don't you go ahead and ask your question?
My question is about earaches. I really understand how beneficial it is to wait and not give antibiotics immediately. But what do you do for the pain of an earache?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, and that's actually the most common issue that we come up with earaches with parents, because clearly we're not going to leave a child suffer while we debate the benefits of antibiotics or no antibiotics. We always treat with a topical anesthetic. It comes under many different names. One of the common ones is Oralgan. Most of those have benzocaine, which is a topical anesthetic similar to lidocaine, and it can be used safely in virtually any age child.
Eardrops?
I'm sorry?
These are eardrops?
These are eardrops, and they go inside the ear. We also use topical things like garlic and mullein oil, which also relieves not only infection but some of the pain symptoms as well. And in fact, some of the more recent studies have shown that early use of antibiotics does no better a job at pain relief or fever relief than use of no antibiotics at all. And those studies are very, very dramatic, not only here but in Europe as well. So we always advocate the use of pain relief, and it could be an oral pain relief like acetaminophen or ibuprofen. But whether we treat or not, we always take care of the pain first.
Aha. Uh-huh. And the fever could be handled by
just
good children.
Absolutely. Children, unlike adults, handle fever beautifully. You know, if an adult gets 101 fever, they're going to be horribly, horribly sick and uncomfortable and will not be able to function, whereas a child with 105 fever is often bouncing off the walls and having a great time playing. So clearly children are much more adept at handling fever than we are. And
but
we should
you still treat the fever.
Oh, yeah, we do. You know, in my own children personally, and I know Dr. Russ feels very much the same, we don't treat every fever in a child, but we treat the fevers where the child is uncomfortable. If they're in discomfort, and agonizing over the fever, we always treat it, whether it be with hydration or acetaminophen or sponge baths. But in some cases, in my own children, I actually don't treat every fever.
But that hydration is very important.
Absolutely. That's the best way to lower a fever is with fluid.
Okay. With regards to ear pain, one thing just to know about, last month in a journal called the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine, there's an article on something called Oticon, which is a naturopathic remedy for ear pain, which is, again, eardrop in the type of format that it is. And it's a mixture of things like garlic and calendula and even a little bit of St. John's wort, all in a liquid format, and was shown to work just as well as the conventional anesthetic eardrops.
Why the St. John's wort, I wonder?
I'm sorry?
Why the St. John's wort, which is...
Well, you know, I kind of wondered myself. I don't know why, but I can't imagine that it gets absorbed, so I wouldn't worry about it, any systemic effects. But to be honest with you, it may have some. It has been used for pain relief in other instances, but I had not heard of it being used for ear infections or ear aches before.
Even bacteria get depressed. So.
Well, thank you so much. I'll look forward to hearing the name of the book.
All right. Well, we'll do that in just a second here. I will reintroduce our guests for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Drs. Stuart Dichick and Russell Greenfield. They are together the authors of this book we've mentioned. And the title is Healthy Child, Whole Child. And the subtitle is Integrating the Best of Conventional and Alternative Medicine to Keep Your Kids Healthy. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I think it's come out fairly recently. The beginning of July, I guess, was the official day, so it should be out there in bookstores if you'd like to look at it. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. For a moment here, before we go on to the next caller, and we'll get on to this other person, one thing I want to get to is immunization, because you write about it in the book, and you seem to believe in it. And I want to raise the question, because on and off, over the past few years, I guess, we have been hearing about some people really being concerned about potential harmful side effects of immunizations and what these vaccines may or may not be doing. And in fact, I think there are some people who are afraid to have their children immunized for that reason. And I think that you would go along with much of the pediatric community and say, in fact, that you think it is a good thing. And that if we suddenly had large numbers of kids who were not being immunized, that we would very quickly start to see that that was a problem. And whatever problems may come with immunization, it's much less so than if we had large numbers of kids suddenly having things like whooping cough and measles and so forth.
Yeah, I think I'll just jump in quickly. It's a very that's a show in itself, discussing, you know, immunizations, sure, and the risks and benefits. But what I will say is Dr. Russ and I do feel very strongly, yes, we do agree with the conventional approach of immunizing children. However, with one difference, we believe that the open discussion that needs to go on between parents and pediatricians has to be welcomed into the pediatric office in a more open way. And you can't really blame pediatricians because with the stresses of managed care, they don't always have the time to get into every scientific detail of what immunizations are beneficial, why they're beneficial, and what are the best techniques to approach them. So what Dr. Russ and I advocate in our book is, number one, we give parents a lot of resources on which immunization literatures to look at and where to get the accurate literature. That's number one. Number two is we kind of teach parents and pediatricians on the chapter on immunizations how to approach immunizations in a logical way, whereas a pediatrician should not be judgmental when a parent is questioning it. You know, don't become defensive because parents are worried about doing something actively to harm their child. And what we always point out is that pediatricians, who are, I believe, the most altruistic of physicians, would never do anything to harm a child, and they believe passionately in immunizations, and they believe in it based on the scientific literature. So really, that's, I think, our consensus. Maybe Dr. Russ has something else to add to that.
Really, no. I mean, the only thing that I would just echo is that what we try to put forth in the book is that parents should realize that no pediatrician would ever offer something to their child if they thought it would hurt them. And pediatricians need to realize that parents have good questions that need to be answered. And so the battle line should not be drawn at all. It should be understood that the goal for each participant is to optimize the child's health.
All right. Well, let's take another caller here. This is Champagne, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, this is sort of a pretty basic question. You were talking about, you know, using herbal remedies and this, that, and the other thing. So what happens if you have a teenager that's allergic to ragweed, and you name the plant, she's probably allergic to it. Is this going to be a if I wanted to give her an herbal remedy with calendula or whatever, and let's say she's allergic to it, I mean, how do you know? What do you do?
There are certain precautions that you can take. Like, for example, you know, most everybody has heard about the herbal remedy echinacea nowadays, which has been used to try and help either prevent or shorten the duration of colds. And it's well known that people who are allergic to daisies or things of that nature can be allergic to echinacea. So it does help to actually do a little bit of homework before going out and purchasing the herbal remedy to find out, you know, what the family of flowers that the agent comes from is, so that if indeed you or your loved one does have an allergy to that kind of agent, like ragweed or something of that nature, you can find out by doing a little bit of homework and checking into that. With regards to some of the others, where because we don't know everything that our children are allergic to, it, you know, behooves us to start with a low dose initially, especially with a child who has a lot of allergies, just to be certain that it's safe and that they don't have a response to it.
Okay, so presumably if I got a list from the allergist of the things that she tested positive to and I found out the general family and compared that to ingredients?
Yeah, you could compare that to ingredients. And then also you may have to do just a little more homework just in terms of taking a look on the Internet, finding out what the ingredients are, and then looking up and seeing, you know, what those ingredients are with regards to what plant family they're in or what they're related to.
Okay, thanks very much.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. We have maybe about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit less this morning with Drs. Ditcher and Greenfield. And if you have questions, call us. Don't wait till the very end. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have now, I think, again, more and more an issue that we're getting sensitized to when it comes to children is weight. We seem to have a lot of kids who are overweight, and it seems that the reason that we have those kids is they're consuming a lot more calories than they're burning. It may also have to do with the quality of the calories that they're consuming, and it leads to a lot of problems. Also, it's something that we seem to be now seeing more and more, as we're seeing more and more kids with diabetes. Can you talk a little bit about the issue of weight and kids, and how, first of all, how you know if you have a problem, and then how you approach the problem?
Well, the easiest way to look at a child's risk factor for obesity is to, we actually have in our book a BMI chart, or basal metabolic index, which where you can actually plug in the numbers that are appropriate for a BMI chart and see if your child is in the at-risk zone or not and know whether they're at risk for obesity. Most parents and pediatricians don't need a BMI chart to really know whether their child's at risk. You start to see the signs of it early on. The crisis that exists with obesity in the United States should not be underestimated or understated. We're seeing huge numbers of children with type 2, which used to be called adult-onset diabetes, but now it's become a childhood illness and sometimes an adolescent illness. We're also seeing huge number of children, as you said, being exposed to commercialized food products where the servings are huge, the types of fats being used in them are inappropriate for children, and the issue of children not being active anymore, the advent of computers, video games, television, cable television specifically, has made children, has brought children to a tremendous crisis. They no longer come home and burn calories continuously. They come home and spend sometimes 4 to 5 or 6 hours in front of the TV, computer, or video game. So this is a health crisis in the United States, and we need to address it now because we're going to be seeing a lot of young heart attacks. We're already seeing younger heart attacks, people in their late 20s and early 30s. My fear is that if the crisis continues, that we will be seeing children who will grow up to have heart attacks at the age of their younger mid-20s in years to come.
You know, and again, you know, tagging on to what Dr. Stu is talking about, this is a family issue. A parent can't just say, well, we have to focus on our young one's weight. It has to be taken care of as a family, because focusing solely on the little one can make for real problems with regards to self-esteem and things of that nature. And parents have to be role models. So if it's important for your child to stop watching TV or cut back on computer time and things like that, the parents need to do that too. If it's important to increase the activity level, then parents need to do that too and start doing things like going for walks after dinner, or going out in the park and playing, or even doing things like having fun and doing goofy dances together. Anything to increase activity and to really put the focus on maintaining and optimizing health by maintaining and optimizing an ideal weight.
All right. We have several callers. I don't know if we can get them all. We'll try and get it as many as we can. Next is Champagne, line one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
I have read several places that anywhere from 40 to 70% of all the antibiotics manufactured in this country go into animal feed. I wonder if that doesn't have a lot to do with the fact that we're building up this resistance to antibiotics.
Well, that's a great point. You know, antibiotics exposure doesn't only occur in the drugstore. It occurs in milk products, and it occurs in food products that we eat, specifically meat products, because animals are given antibiotics in most circumstances to make them grow bigger and get more bang for your buck when you're a farmer of those animals. What Dr. Russ and I propose is that parents take great effort to purchase organic milk when giving their children milk. That reduces antibiotic exposure dramatically. And we also suggest that when affordable and when possible, that they purchase organic meats that also do not have the antibiotic exposure that other meats do.
Okay. And then, well, nationwide, though, doesn't this have a lot to do with building up resistance nationwide?
It absolutely does, and I echo Dr. Stu's sentiments and yours as well, because you know the reality is that the antibiotics are being used in the feed for these animals, not necessarily to prevent them from getting infections or to treat them for infections. It's to try and optimize their growth and to fatten them up. So they're not only are they being used inappropriately, but they're being passed on to us, and that increases the incidence of resistant bacteria, not just here, but all across the globe. And so this is a very, very big issue. And indeed, we do try and put forth that when appropriate, when it is affordable, to try and find the things that are organically grown or at least grown with care, that there's not overuse of pesticides. And with regards to milk, we, you know, primarily ask that folks make certain they stay away from anything that contains bovine growth hormone or things of that nature. And as Stu said, to try and find some of the free-range meats and chicken and poultry products, things of that nature, to try and minimize exposure for the things specifically that you eat the most of.
Are these products marked in the grocery stores, or how do you know that you're getting that?
In a lot of the grocery stores, they are marked. You know, there's been a problem with labeling of things that are organic and things of that nature. But the government stepped in last year and put through some legislation that now the labeling should be much more secure with regards to what is actually organically grown or not. And specifically in your area of the country, you should be able to find out where the beef and poultry products are coming from and just the way they have been raised. And I would imagine in your part of the country there are a lot of farmers who are being very, very careful about the way that they're raising their produce and their feed.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll try and get one more caller here in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Thank you. Regarding basic immunology, I understand that the excess use of sugar has a way of reducing our immune system to a degree that we're open and vulnerable for about 5 or 6 hours more than if we had not used sugar. Is that something that has been observed?
Well, and I'll tell you
Halloween comes around, you know, all the kids are overdoing the sugar routine with the trick-or-treating or other times of the year with all the excess sodas and ice creams and all, cookies and whatnot. So the point is the immune system gets knocked down to the degree that we're taking in excess sugar.
Right. And I'm going to ask Dr. Russ to comment on the science of it, but I'll tell you the clinical application very quickly. In my practice, very often children that I see with recurrent respiratory infections and recurrent strep throats, we often utilize an approach where we ask the parent to stop the use of processed sugars for a month or two and see if the infections go away and get less. And I would say in a large percentage of those children, it does. To my knowledge, there haven't been any scientific studies on that to date, but as an anecdote in private practice, I clearly, and Dr. Russ, I believe, has had the same experience with his patients, have seen less frequent recurrent infections when you can cut out the use of processed sugar. The other point is that, unfortunately, Halloween is all year round these days in the United States, and kids don't only eat that stuff on Halloween and trick-or-treating, they eat it all year round.
You know, part of that answer is what we put forth in our book is that, you know, what doesn't come into the house usually doesn't get eaten. And so if we're not bringing home the sweets and the candies and treats and things like that, then the kids don't get quite as much exposure to them. With regards to the research, there really isn't a lot to say that, you know, increased ingestion of sweets and things like that leads to a worsening of the immune system in children. However, there's a lot of data in this regards with people who have diabetes. It's very clear that as blood sugar levels go up and as control of blood sugar is worsened, that people are more apt to get certain infections and not to heal quite as quickly from those infections. So we don't say that kids can't have sweets. You know, I'm not a sweet eater myself, but we let our children have sweets every once in a while. But we also bring them up with the knowledge that, you know, sweets are a treat, and they're something to have every once in a while. And there are upsides and downsides to most any food. So enjoy it intermittently, but not on an everyday basis.
There we must stop because we're here at the end of the show. We want to say to you, both of you, thanks very much, Dr. Ditchek and Dr. Greenfield. We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you,
Dave.
Appreciate it.